supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, ADHD is certainly no newcomer to the field of psychology. It's been over 30 years since we first named the disorder. Nevertheless, a surprising amount remains unknown. We tend to think of ADHD typically as a childhood disorder, and government data suggests that about 50% of children affected by ADHD will outgrow their hyperactive tendencies, but that means there are millions and millions of adults who continue to struggle with the disorder long after childhood. In adults, a diagnosis is complicated, it's not clear, and it overlaps with conditions like depression and bipolar disorder. Well, new research is attempting to get a better grip on ADHD, how to recognize it, and there's new interesting treatments coming out around it. And with me is Dr. Tony Rostain, who's going to tell us all about that. He's medical director of the University of Pennsylvania's Adult ADHD Treatment and Research Program, which started in 68. That was way back in the beginning of the field. He's also professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine there. Later on, we'll hear from Linda Joy Goldner. She's a hospital chaplain who's going to share some of her own story with ADD. If you want to join the conversation, we're going to be talking mostly about adult ADD. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, Tony, I hadn't seen you for a couple of years. And frankly, I was surprised last time I saw you. It was at a scientific conference about integrating mindfulness into psychotherapy. And A, I was surprised to see you there, and B, I was surprised to see that you were co-chairing. So what were you doing there?
Well, I've been developing a good relationship with Michael Baim, who runs our mindfulness program at Penn, and he's been collaborating on a study to adapt mindfulness techniques for work with adults with ADHD. And we're almost done with that study. We've got one more wave of patients to come through, but it looks as if using the right kinds of adaptations to mindfulness, you can actually improve people's ability to stay focused and to solve cognitive problems, including ones that are really difficult for them prior to trying the and practicing the mindfulness techniques.
Yeah, I want to unpackage that a bit more later in the show.
Sure, but sure.
Many people have defined mindfulness as cultivating attention.
That's exactly right. And so I deal with patients whose day-to-day life is affected by this disorder, and mindfulness is a goal, but it's a very elusive one because they tend to have scattered attention.
Right. So, okay, so let's go back to the beginning for a minute. According to government data, 8% of children have ADHD, and like I said in the opening, about half of them outgrow it. So tell us about, if you know, Tony, about the half that don't outgrow it.
Well, it's important to realize that only in the last national study of mental disorders was the category of ADHD even included. Now, we've been sampling epidemiologically adult mental disorders for the last 60 years, but it wasn't until early 2000s when they asked the respondents to this survey, do you have problems with paying attention? And literally giving them a screening instrument for ADHD, and lo and behold, over 4% of the sample reported ADHD symptoms currently. And out of that group, only 1 in 10 were actually getting help. Now, we are very, very aware of hyperactivity in children. In adults, it tends to be transformed more into restlessness, difficulty settling, and the impulsivity that we see in children tends to transform into frustration intolerance, or what some people call delay aversion, the inability to wait. And we see it manifest, for example, in things like road rage and in situations where most of us might be able to handle a little bit of a delay. These individuals have a really hard time. Now, the inattention stays. That's something that's persistent from childhood into these adults that we see. Only as you're an adult, you're supposed to self-regulate and manage your time better. So it actually becomes even more difficult as we age, because the supports and the structures around us often aren't there anymore.
So the it sounds almost like we find a way to compensate as we age for the inattentiveness, but it's the emotions, the emotional dysregulation that become a problem.
Well, again, it's a spectrum. Again, I see those who don't compensate so well, but most adults can find ways to get planners or develop strategies for staying on focus and on task. Although, as we know, our current world is getting more and more distracting. But yes, the difficulty with emotional self-regulation is what we're referring to it as, has become a greater and greater focus of our work. And so we no longer just look at ADHD as a group of symptoms. We really look at it as a complex disorder of frontal lobe functioning, of both the ability to think in present and in future terms, and we talk about executive functioning. And within that, we talk also a lot about the capacity to regulate emotions, whether they be good emotions or negative emotions.
In a recent New York Times article, columnist Melinda Beck suggested that half of the people in Manhattan could probably be diagnosed with ADHD. But it does get to the reality that these symptoms are more pervasive
exactly.
than ever. I was saying earlier when we were talking about the show, I was saying I probably had some mild ADHD in my younger life, and now, I've got the attention of a chipmunk on steroids. It's just gone.
Well, okay, so you're raising a couple of points that I really want to underscore. Number one, people joke about ADHD a lot and say, oh, don't we all have it? And the truth is, we all have moments when we don't pay attention well or when we're easily distracted. For example, when we're tired or when we're not feeling well or when we're overscheduled. But the person that I'm describing to you who has ADHD, this has been a problem since they were really young, and it didn't suddenly occur when they hit menopause or age, the later parts of life. I mean, we have other terms for individuals who are losing their cognitive abilities later in life. We're talking about a developmental disorder that does transform over time because people learn to compensate. But the problem is some of their strategies are not so good. So, for example, you see tons of students in college and in university who wait to the last minute to get things done because their major strategy for dealing with the difficulty of multitasking and taking on a complex project is to procrastinate. And we call it pathologic procrastination, which is different than your day-to-day procrastination. So we try to help understand those compensatory strategies and try to address them with our patients.
Mm. We're talking about ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, primarily in adults, with psychiatrist Tony Rostain. He's medical director of that program at University of Pennsylvania. Want to join the conversation? Our number is 888-477-9499. That's 888-477-9499. If you are wondering about yourself, or if you are living with a partner with that you think might have adult ADHD and We're going to talk about what that does to relationships later on. But give us a call, 888-477-9499. Tony, a colleague of mine who treats many people with ADHD, says that it goes hand in hand, she finds, in her practice, with depression.
Yes.
And certainly many of the symptoms of depression, you know, they can... It can scatter attention, it can make you impatient, so on and so forth. So that many of the symptoms of depression mimic ADHD.
That's right. Well, again, ADHD we think of as a trait that you've had a long time. Depression is a state we get into and out of. Of course, we can become chronically depressed, and many of our patients do, because ADHD leads to great deals of difficulty with success, not meeting expectations, social rejection. So it's not uncommon. In fact, in our program, 75% of our patients come in and have either anxiety, depression, or both when we treat them. So it's not just that we can't the brain doesn't separate one from the other. We have to look at it as a total package.
Can we look at it both ways, Tony? Excuse me. If you have ADD as a child, have it across the lifespan, you've got a long history of being criticized and rejected and told you're not good enough and so
exactly.
on and so forth. So what does that do, not just to self-esteem, but that could be a precursor for depression or an anxiety disorder.
Right. So we've noticed, number one, that these individuals develop what we call self-mistrust. It's a view of yourself that you can't always rely on yourself, you're not always there in the ways you need to be, and others, of course, tell you all the time, you're not responsible, you're not coming through when you need to. I think the anxiety comes up especially in performance situations. So these individuals have tremendous social anxiety because they're afraid they're going to blow it in social situations. And they have tremendous anxiety around performance, like either work or school. The depression eventually comes in after repeated failure and repeated loss without compensatory successes. If you're not succeeding most of the time in whatever you're doing, eventually you become depressed.
Marty Seligman over there in your house talks about
learned
helplessness. I want to talk about diagnosis, because too many people, adults and children, sit with somebody for a half hour and get diagnosed and medicated. So how does one get diagnosed correctly, and where do you go?
Well, first of all, it's important that you get a thorough evaluation from somebody who knows about ADHD, a psychologist, a psychiatrist who has familiarity. It doesn't have to be a specialty practice, but it has to be a practitioner who's familiar with the diagnosis and doesn't dispute its existence. Now, there are some doubters out there who think that everybody has bipolar disorder or has some other disorder, not ADHD. But the truth is, you have to be fair and balanced in your approach to the patient. The workup needs to include very careful early history, especially educational history. How did you do in school? What were your biggest difficulties when it came to carrying out assignments? As well as family history. And the family history tells us a lot, because most of the time it'll be one or another parent, sometimes both parents, who have some of these symptoms. But and actually, parenting with ADHD is another remarkably complicated challenge. And I'd say that at least in the early stages of our clinic, many patients came to see us who came after their children were diagnosed. They said, "Oh my goodness, this is still me," and so that's another path into the diagnosis. So it has to be with a competent person. There needs to be some attention paid to current functioning and stresses in life, and certainly not trying to exclude depression versus, or make it an ADHD versus anxiety or depression discussion, but rather a holistic one.
And is the first line of treatment medication?
The first line of treatment is actually psychoeducation, we call it. Is learning about the disorder, understanding what it is, what it isn't, how it's impacting on you, and becoming an informed person. In fact, I will not prescribe anything till someone's done their homework, as I say, which includes going online and looking at some of the wonderful web-based resources and reading a short article so that they understand the relative merits or not of different medications. Now, medications are a mainstay, but as we're learning over time, they're not, pills don't teach skills. So you might be able to pay attention better, but if you're using your attention to read Wired magazine or Rolling Stone instead of studying or doing your work assignments, then you're really not going to benefit optimally. So medications work best when they're implemented within a bigger framework that we call the multimodal treatment approach.
So let me get some free supervision from you.
Sure.
A perk.
Delighted.
It's a perk of this gig, I guess.
Good.
So somebody comes into my office. Tell me what behaviors I'm looking at, what thought process, what emotion. Tell me how to
Okay, so it, of course it varies, but if it's the person who's had the combined type of ADHD, what they'll often talk to you about is easy frustration, losing their temper with people they care about, getting overexcited, not being able to handle daily stress like others around them. So they'll speak to you a lot about their emotional dysregulation, or as Russ Barkley calls it, their emotional impulsivity. They'll often be making decisions before they thought about them and then ruining the consequences. So they might present with a series of discussions to you of how this impacts their life, and you'll want to look at the functional impact. Maybe another patient will come in who's not as impulsive or not as unable to handle delay, but they're talking to you a lot about how distracted they are and how easily thrown off they are from completing tasks. So they'll start to read, somebody will interrupt them, they won't be able to get back to what they were reading. Or if they were talking to a friend and somebody else is talking in the background, they won't be able to screen that other voice. And they'll mention to you at work, for example, I can't get anything done because the phones are always ringing around me and I'm in a cubicle and I'm hearing all the noise. So you can begin to hear this person reporting easy distractibility and trouble completing tasks. And then last but not least, a myriad of stories about projects started and unfinished, tasks left undone, you know, and it's beyond just a messy desk. It's almost like their lives are in a constant state of disarray.
So, listen, our phone lines are lit up, no surprise there. And we've got Linda Joy Goldner coming in just right after our break, which is coming up now. But you know, I'm listening to this supervision session you've offered me, and I appreciate it. And my next question is, do you have room in your practice for another patient? Because
we have a great group practice at Penn in our adult ADHD treatment and research program.
Well, you've been listening to Anthony Rostain, Tony Rostain. He's a psychiatrist, medical director of the University of Pennsylvania Adult ADHD Treatment and Research Program. He's also professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at the Perelman School at the University of Pennsylvania. Right after our break, we're going to hear from Linda Joy Goldman, a hospital chaplain, who was going to tell us story of her life with ADHD. And I promise to my callers, we will get to you right after the break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Parents, do you feel like you are losing your teenager to drugs and alcohol? If substance abuse is causing changes in your relationship with your child and you don't know where to go, the Family Training Program is conducting a research study that may be able to help. If eligible, you will be invited to individual sessions with a family specialist, which may help you regain control of your family. This study is held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2 or IAmConcerned.org. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
This is Marty Moskowain. As our fiscal year comes to a close on June 30th, we thank you for being with us through this year of uncertain funding. Now, as we begin a new fiscal year, we ask for your support. Your support helps to provide the funds necessary to broadcast and produce local programs like Radio Times and Newsworks.org. Do your part now to propel WHYY into the next fiscal year. Visit WHYY.org, and thank you.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about adult ADHD today on Voices in the Family. We're here with Tony Rostain, who's the medical director at the University of Pennsylvania Adult ADHD Treatment and Research Program. And now we're joined by Linda Joy Goldner, a hospital chaplain who has ADD and has had it, Linda Joy, I assume, your whole life.
Yes.
Just like Tony described. When did you first realize there was something wrong with you?
Two-step process, I guess. As a child, I was hyperactive. I would run my mother ragged. She would ship me off to our grandparents' house sometimes just to give herself a little break. In school, I used to be kept after school quite a bit in elementary school. I must learn to raise my hand in class 100 times.
Did you feel there was something wrong with you back then?
I felt I was different, but I just felt quite high energy.
How did you feel about yourself?
I felt like I was a pain in the neck, but I was well-loved. I didn't feel like I was being seriously disparaged for my behavior. However, as I got older, by, I'd say, junior high school, I started to, I guess, be taking a lot of standardized testing, and my teachers learned what my IQ was, and I really started to take a lot of chiding about my grades. My grades, Linda, you're not trying. And my parents would pick up on that. And it was very frustrating to me because I thought I was trying.
What was it like to live inside your head?
It was like having thoughts spilling constantly through my mind so that I couldn't grab hold of anyone for any period of time. I couldn't prioritize. Everything had to be done, whether it was clipping a fingernail or beginning a paper for my science project. Mm. Everything at once.
And what about the emotions?
The emotions built, I guess, as I got older. I became increasingly anxious. Originally, the anxiety would be attached to some particular series of tasks or predicament I was in. But as I got older, the anxiety became more free-floating.
Hmm. Your parents had a friend who was a psychiatrist who medicated you, yes?
Yes.
What did he put you on?
He put me on Ritalin. It was a test to learn or to prove to me his thesis that I had ADD, and I was in my mid-20s.
What year was that?
About 1977 or so.
What did we know about Ritalin and ADD back then, Tony?
Well, you know, interestingly, Wender Wood, Reimer, and colleagues at Utah had begun writing about adult ADHD in the mid-1970s, but they were really very small studies. Not everybody picked up on them, but it was the very earliest days of recognizing it in adults, and I would say that the family's friend and psychiatrist was quite forward-thinking in those days.
So, you know, Linda Joy, you said that the psychiatrist put you on that as a test of Ritalin, a test to see if you actually had it. So when it worked, it proved to him, I guess, and you that you had it.
It was an interesting kind of work because I didn't know what ADD was then. It wasn't, you know, as Dr. Rostain said, in the popular press. And he said, just take this medication for a few days, give me a call, tell me what happens.
And what happened?
I turned into the Buddha. I became calm. I had one thought at a time. I could listen to music without my thoughts driving me quite out of the room. I prioritized. I knew what was important and what wasn't. It was really amazing. Mm. And he said, you have ADD. He said, if you didn't, you would have gotten very, very agitated because this is a stimulant medication.
Is that true? Is that a fair diagnostic test?
It's fair. It's not foolproof. Most people will benefit a little bit from a stimulant. It'll help them. Folks sit still for longer, and it'll keep you awake, which is why it's misused, for example, by college students who don't have ADHD. But this remarkable transformation from mind wandering everywhere to feeling like the Buddha, that's quite an impressive, and I'd say, yes, it's a diagnostic test, if you want to call it that.
Tell us about the first ADD clinic you founded in 60.
Well, I didn't found it in 1960. We founded our adult program in 1998. Penn began its treatment clinics in the 60s. But we started a child program at Children's Hospital in the 1980s, okay? And a lot of those kids began to grow up and didn't have anywhere to go. And I continued to follow them. So by the time 1998 rolled around and I was moving into the adult realm, I brought along a lot of these kids who are now in their 20s and 30s. And I still follow a number of them, actually. Mm-hmm. I have patients who I've been following for close to 30 years. And in the early days, all we had was Ritalin. All we had was one medication. We didn't tend to use much dexedrine in those days, although that became another option. But in recent times, we've grown to understand the disorder, and we now have many more options than those early medications. It's true, though, that the studies that I mentioned from the Utah group found a very strong benefit from stimulant in patients who had ADHD. Most of them, by the way, they had first seen for treatment of alcoholism, and this was another important coexisting condition.
Apropos of that, we've got Samantha on the line.
Okay.
who's got a question that's very, very parallel to what you're talking about. Samantha?
Hi.
Hey.
This is a wonderful topic.
Why, thank you. Thank you.
So I was diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder when I was 8 years old and put on Luvox. And very similar to Linda's story, I was doing very well in school at first, had a really high IQ test, and then when I got to high school, it kind of all fell apart, and it was really difficult for me to focus, but I wasn't jumping off the walls, yet I couldn't get anything done, and I started doing drugs. Now, I've been sober for almost 5 years. I got sober when I was 18. I'm 23 now, and I got diagnosed with ADHD about 3 years ago, and it made so much sense to me after reading. But my issue has been that I've seen several different doctors, and all of them have guided me towards medication. And my question is just, what's the best route of treatment when taking those stimulants are really not an option?
All right, Samantha, don't hang up, okay?
Okay.
Stick with us. Dr. Rustin.
Well, first of all, Samantha, congratulations on being in recovery for 5 years. I know it's not easy. I salute you, and your efforts to stay sober are really important to your health. It turns out that more and more we are recognizing that the coexistence of obsessive compulsive and other anxiety disorders in children coexist with ADHD. And like you said, it's when you have to do lots of things and keep track of lots of things that it's probably the most difficult. And that's why we see a lot of patients coming to see us in high school and college. It's when the demands outstrip the resources of the individual, even though the individual is bright. The executive functioning doesn't keep up with the demands. So I think the first and most important step is for you to look at and take an assessment of where in your life right now the ADHD is manifesting, and to try and address it partly through cognitive behavioral therapy, and also to get a consultation from someone who can look at non-stimulant medications for ADHD if you're choosing to stay away from them.
For example?
Well, for example, atomoxetine or Strattera, which is the first non-stimulant that was ever developed and tested for ADHD children and adults. It has a very good effect, a prolonged efficacy. Once you're on it, you can stay on the same dose for years. And another one that we've now been getting more data on is guanfacine and clonidine. These are medications, again, that have been around for a long time. They're blood pressure medications, but they tend to reduce anxiety and they tend to improve focusing. And both of those are possibilities that you might look into, Samantha.
Let me stop you for a minute. Samantha, how do you feel about what Tony said about those other medications? Are you hesitant about them, or do you feel open to
trying? Well, you know, it's as an addict and growing up in my generation, you see how much people can get addicted to certain stimulant medications. So it's always been my mind that it's absolutely not an option. But I think that if I could get very thorough explanations from a therapist that would be willing to work with behavioral things as well, it would be something I'd be willing to try.
Well, listen to the show because we're going to talk more about this emotional dysregulation and what can be done about it. There's lots that can be done beyond medication. It's a critical issue, and even the issue of executive function we're going to learn more about during the show. So stick with us, Samantha, and congratulations.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Linda Joy, when Samantha talked about her fear of stimulants because of she wanted a non-stimulant approach to treating it, you got all excited over there.
Yes.
How come?
Because I did not get treatment beyond a couple of weeks, let's say, of the Ritalin in my mid-20s. At the time, I felt I didn't need it for the kind of work I was doing. I didn't seek treatment again until I was around 50. And I, at the time, fell into the hands of a pediatric neurologist who began to treat me with increasingly high doses of a long-acting version of Ritalin. As observed by others, my behavior was getting increasingly erratic, bizarre, high-strung, and so forth. And my sister, who's a physician, was aware that the dose that I was getting was actually about three times the highest recommended dose of that medication. I could have died. It was a terrible time, and I was able to get on the appointment book of Dr. Rothstein, who, to be dramatic, rescued me. He recommended Strattera for me, and I found that the effects were not as dramatic as what I recalled from my mid-20s. But perhaps my body has changed, my whatever has changed. I can no longer take the stimulant medication safely. And Strattera is good enough. I do very well with that and also actually with the 10X.
You know, it's interesting, both of you, that, you know, the ages we're hearing about fit with brain-body changes. We heard from Samantha, about how things changed for her when she, A, went to school, B, hit her 20s or 18, and that's when the brain changes.
Right.
And that's when in the 20, there's dramatic changes in the brain. And now we're hearing from you, Linda Joy, about changes, when you're 40, 50 years mm-hmm. old, and perimenopausal, and that's dramatic changes.
You know, just to speak to the issue, everybody's got a different chemistry and everybody's at a different stage in their life, and it's important that whoever's treating you understand who you are, where you've been, what you've tried, what does or doesn't agree with you, and we talk about individualizing or personalizing care at this point. And I think it's too quick, people are too quick to just, you know, say, oh, start this medication without thinking through, well, what are the side effects, and let's go through carefully what your fears are so that you're not approaching it through a distorted view of the medicine, but rather a realistic one.
And before we break, I just want to preach what's most important to me, to whoever treats anyone, treat people and not symptoms.
Exactly.
And our field exactly. is going more and more in the whole field of medicine, more and more towards treating symptoms. And to consumers out there, if you've got a doctor or therapist who's treating symptoms and not people, you're not in good hands. So that's my mantra. We're gonna take a break. We're talking about adult ADHD with two very knowledgeable and wise experts. Dr. Tony Rothstein is medical director of the University of Pennsylvania Adult ADHD Treatment and Research Program. Linda Joy Goldner has had ADHD all of her life, I assume. She's now a hospital chaplain, and we're going to hear about how and why she switched careers later in her life and how that's related to her ADD. Well, we'll be back in 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Longwood Gardens supports WHYY and welcomes the Philadelphia Orchestra for an evening of classics under the stars, Saturday, July 2nd. Longwood's Meadow transforms into a stage where conductor Asher Fish will lead the Philadelphia Orchestra playing classics such as Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, the Violin Concerto No. 1 by Bruch, and Emperor Waltz by Strauss, including a violin solo by Concertmaster David Kim. The Philadelphia Orchestra at Longwood Gardens, July 2nd. Information available at longwoodgardens.org.
He is a dedicated writer, but with a day job that gives him little time for solitude.
When I have quiet moments, traveling in my hotel room, or sometimes I wake up early in the morning and the muse descends on me, I just take my laptop and start pounding away.
Those quiet moments when he isn't busy serving as vice president of one of Africa's best governed countries, that is, the vice president of Ghana is with us next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about adult ADHD with Tony Rostain, Medical Director of the University of Pennsylvania Adult ADHD Treatment and Research Program, and a psychiatrist and psychotherapist par excellence. We're also talking with, you owe me for that, Tony.
Thanks.
We're also talking with Linda Joy Goldner, who's a hospital chaplain who's had ADD, ADHD all of her life. Linda Joy, you taking medication today?
Yes.
And any other form of treatment?
I think if Dr. Rostain will back me on this, he felt I needed no real cognitive therapy. By luck, my mother was a bookkeeper. My father had a finance company. And between the two of them, they had very regular ways of doing things, and they kind of schooled me in management. And I just needed the will to implement those different systems and so forth, and later the medication to make it a reasonable sort of investment of my time.
I've got a simple question for you. What's it like to be you?
Ooh.
What's it like inside?
I would have to be more dramatic, I'd have to go back to before medication, if you would like.
Okay.
With medication, I feel great. I can prioritize. I can have a concept of a thought before it comes out of my mouth. I can sort of shut off or not even pick up on certain wandering behaviors in which I might engage. But more dramatically, I can talk about what it was like before ADD. I actually presented a paper to my colleagues in the chaplaincy that described what the process would have been in writing a paper without medication. And I detailed the sorts of tangential thoughts that might have come out of that process and how I would go off exploring in that tangent and how much time that would take. And then I'd maybe return, but then something else would occur to me. So it's kind of like juggling 12 things all at once and never being able to grasp anything.
Are you, you know, I wanted to mention this to Tony earlier when I see people in my office. Many just don't feel comfortable inside their own skin. And do you now?
Yes. And I, to some extent, did before because I wasn't subjected to the amount of abuse that many other children get with ADD. And that was because of my talent in art. Thank God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very early on, that was evident.
We've got a ton of callers who want to join the conversation. And I want to pin you down, Tony, about this emotional dysregulation and what can be done. Let's go to the phones first. We've got Suzanne on the phone.
Hello.
Hi, Suzanne.
I have listened to your show so much. I just love your show, so thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm an adult ADD person. I have spent my adult time working with students who also have ADD and giving them strategies. I have a doctorate in education, and my research centered on those distractions that they get. But by teaching them and by working in with mindful meditation, I no longer need to take the medication that I was taking. I took it for 10 years, and I'm now off of it, and I'm able to compensate just as well, if not better, than when I was on it. So.
I've got a simple question for you now.
Sure.
How did you do that?
How did I? Because I'm also a dyslexic, and I have great tenacity, and I won't fail, and so I just kept working. And I'm in my 50s, and I also raised three boys who also have ADD and some dyslexia, and I just keep working. I just keep going.
You know, bless your heart, Suzanne.
Thank
you. You know, it is amazing. You know, people think dyslexia is a problem, and
yes,
certainly it is, but it is amazing what we get from these difficulties earlier on. It does teach tenacity. Thanks so much, Suzanne.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, Suzanne kind of leads us into the question I wanted to ask you about. We started off talking about mindfulness, and I want to talk about this emotional dysregulation, which is a major issue for adult ADHD and many adults in general. So tell us what we're doing for that.
Sure. And let me just say, I think Suzanne represents what I call the resilient person with ADHD, who not only gets the treatment that's offered, but goes beyond and tries to find new ways to help themselves and the people they love. And luckily, she's also got a profession that's suited to her. And that's an important message here. Before we even talk about treatment, people have to find an environment that they can succeed in. And oftentimes, we see people who've chosen paths for their careers or chosen relationships that are just not good for them. So it's important to look and take stock of who you are and to focus on those strengths, to build on those strengths to overcome the areas of disability.
In life.
It's in life. It's for everybody. But the reason I mention it is that we're moving more and more to looking at ADHD as a chronic, long-term disability that individuals need to learn to cope with rather than to cure or to get rid of, so to speak. And just like you said, you know, sometimes disabilities give you new insights. How do you work with who you are and what the disability challenges are for you? And to see them as challenges, not as, obstacles that can never be overcome. So with respect to mindfulness, for example, one of the most interesting discoveries we made at Penn as we were developing our cognitive behavioral therapy approach was that we looked at the literature, and lo and behold, a group in Germany, Heslinger and Philipson, had taken Margaret Linehan's work on DBT for borderline personality.
That's called dialectical behavioral therapy.
Exactly. Dialectical behavioral therapy. And one of the key ingredients of dialectical behavioral therapy is mindfulness and in also distress tolerance. And so her approach teaches individuals, both in group and in individual formats, how to both monitor your emotional state and then how to begin to observe it and get a distance from it so that it doesn't dominate what you're thinking and what you're doing with your behaviors. And this technique was adapted by these German researchers, and they were finding great success with it. Well, we've been developing our own approach to cognitive behavioral therapy, but we found this to be very, very useful as a metaphor, which is to say that if you can begin to monitor and track the emotional state you're in before acting on it, observing it, learning to let it tell you what's going on that you need to pay attention to, and then through that process of reflection, becoming less impulsive, less reactive. And I'm not surprised that our caller over time has learned to wean herself off of medication, because this is the kind of skill, with practice, people can get better at it.
I want to say something to our listeners, because I'm going to get a lot of follow-up emails for somebody who's looking for an expert in dialectical behavior therapy. And I just want to say that you don't have to find somebody who is an expert on DBT, that many good therapists integrate mindfulness into their psychotherapy practice and
help
us take a look at the emotions that's happening right there in the
audience. Well, and it turns out, you see, that ADHD and borderline personality are not the only disorders in which emotional regulation is a challenge. So same with bipolar disorder. It's just, the important point here is that techniques for helping people understand their emotions, where they come from, and how to get a different relationship to your own emotions is something that we think is very helpful in treating adults with ADHD.
Apropos of that, we've got John on line three. Hey, John.
Hello.
Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? I just want to say thank you for the program and your people's input. It's really a great topic.
Thank you.
And what I wanted to ask, I guess, is in the circumstance of someone like myself who, you know, like your previous caller, happens to have mild dyslexia and also been diagnosed with dysthymia, but I was listening to your program, I'm like, oh my gosh, this sounds very, very much a part of what I've gone through. How can it get masked? How does one get diagnosed when masked with possible other issues, and how to address that, or where to seek help, you know, within that.
All right, don't hang up, because I want to get specific with you and see if we can get you to the right place too, Tony.
So, first of all, people diagnose what they see in the office. Someone walks into a therapist or a psychiatrist and says, I'm down, I'm feeling upset and angry, or I can't handle my life. They're mostly going to clue in on your emotional state. Having a problem with reading may also make it a longer standing difficulty that you're dealing with. When we add, though, to this a notion of either trouble planning, trouble with executive functions, okay, getting things done in a timely fashion, the inefficiency, if you will, of your problem-solving approach, along with what we might call this emotional dysregulation, then I would urge you to mention to your treaters, hey, you know, I just was listening to a show, and I'm wondering, maybe some of this applies to me. Especially, we see a lot of individuals who have inattentive type of ADHD with no history of impulsivity or hyperactivity, who were not diagnosed because they were just being treated for their depression or for their mood disorder. So one of the most common entry points to our program is someone who's being treated by a very good person for their depression or their dysthymia, and they're still not quite right. They're still not better. And that's, I think, an important take-home message.
We should look
into that.
We should jump in for our listeners that dysthymia is kind of a low-grade depression. It's kind of a non-quite clinical depression. John, I hope that was helpful for you.
Yes, thank you, and I really appreciate it.
Good, good. Linda Joy, we talked about how you switched careers.
Yes.
So tell us the career switch story. Why did you do it?
I did it because I was becoming less and less stimulated by my career as a graphic designer, art director. I gravitated to chaplaincy work, and I want to jump ahead to say that what Dr. Rothstein was talking about the need to understand oneself and reflect upon oneself, is absolutely inherent in proper chaplaincy training. So I realized just sitting here, I'm having an epiphany. That's another reason why I love this work.
Yeah, yeah. So why did you switch careers? By the way, people mm-hmm. who have epiphanies, you have to pay an extra dollar for being on the show. It's the epiphany charge.
That's cool.
Yeah, we didn't talk about that. So why did you switch careers?
I think I wasn't really truly an artist. Number one, I think art was a skill I had that was superior. I was praised for it all through school. It got me off the hook in many cases where my behaviors were a little bit off because of probably the ADD, where my performance was a little bit off. I went to art school, Rhode Island School of Design, a fine school, but we were not reading heavy literature.
Right, right. And, you know, it's like I tell my daughters, just because you're good at it, that doesn't mean it's right for you. How does chaplaincy jibe with your ADHD? Is it helpful?
Yeah. One of the side benefits of ADD is that we hyperfocus, or many of us hyperfocus, so that when I'm with a patient, a person might think, well, she's probably not able to pay attention. But on the other hand, I am utterly almost merged in my consciousness with that patient. It is a very, very powerful feeling and a very empathetic feeling. And I can be present for them in a profound way.
Yeah, I talked earlier in the show about my attention sometimes being like a chipmunk on steroids, not when I'm with a patient. I am just focused with that human, and my whole life is unfolding right
well,
there.
Well, let me jump in and
we've
say
only,
that
we've one, only got a second.
Okay, that one of the reasons that it was important for Linda Joy to come to treatment when she did was that she was looking to change the direction in her life and finding the right kind of vocational path and making the right kinds of choices, finding coaches, finding mentors. All of this is part of what I think we need to think about in dealing with adults with ADD.
So true. Unfortunately, we are completely out of time. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. Tony Rostain is a medical director of the Adult ADHD Treatment and Research Program at University of Pennsylvania. Linda Joy is a hospital chaplain who's done a fabulous job sharing her story with us. Thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Next week on Voices in the Family, we've got something special. We hope you've been reading The Story of Beautiful Girl, because we're going to discuss the book with author Rachel Simon and have some other guests on also as we talk about institutions in the 20th century for people with developmental disabilities, how inhumanely they were treated here in our neighborhood also. Well, if you want to reach us, we're at voices@whyy.org, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn's our producer. Our interns are Emily Haas, who, by the way, directed our show. Thank you, Emily. And Evan Pliss is our intern. Well, me? Oh, I forgot. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.